guardian.co.uk.
Have you always wanted to write a novel, a history, a short story, your epitaph? Want to know how successful authors do it? It's all in a new Guardian book. I'll tell you more at the end of this podcast.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
You are listening to audio drama in a darker shade. And now our feature presentation.
Whether it's literature, television or film, crime has always been a popular genre with wide appeal.
I think crime fiction is reassuring for us. Crime fiction is quite conservative because in the end it usually gives us a kind of reassuring answer. What it says to us is, look, evil can be thwarted. And we don't always get those solutions in real life.
Sol Hughes Writer writes, there's a long and strong history of left-wing, or at least political crime fiction, where you can find a lot of my favourites, from Dashiell Hammett's Red Harvest onwards. Strong contenders in this area include The Smiler with the Knife, Nicholas Blake in 1938, Charming English Amateur Detectives Fight Threatened Fascist Coup.
Crime and thrillers, thrillers and crime. Which is which? And where did it all come from anyway? Here's what one grande dame had to say about it.
I have written light-hearted murder stories and serious crime stories and technical extravaganzas like Ten Little Niggers. I have laid a crime story in ancient Egypt and a murder play on a modern Nile steamer. I have had the conventional body in the library and bodies in aeroplanes and on boats and in trans-European trains. Hercule Poirot has made quite a place for himself in the world and is regarded perhaps with more affection by outsiders than by his own creator. I would give one piece of advice to young detective writers. Be very careful what central character you create. You may have him with you for a very long time.
Yes, that was none other than Agatha Christie, or the Duchess of Death, as she was dubbed by an American magazine. And that line comes from a long-forgotten essay, which, apart from criticising her own characters, dishes out some stern verdicts on her peers in the murder racket. Arthur Conan Doyle, the pioneer of detective writing, but Marjorie Allingham, inclined to subordinate plot to characters, sniffed the Duchess. She's so interested in them that the denouement of the crime sometimes comes rather flatly as inevitable rather than as a surprising bombshell. Well, with me in the studio is the publisher who brought this jewelled dagger of an essay back into the light of day. He's David Braun and he's publisher of estates at HarperCollins. With us too is Laura Wilson, an award-winning crime novelist in her own right, who just happens also to be the Guardian's crime reviewer. Welcome to both of you. David, would you just begin by explaining how you came by a forgotten essay by Agatha Christie and how it came to be written?
Well, I was putting together what was the last book of Agatha Christie short stories in the late 1990s. And I was working with the agent, Brian Stone, on pulling together all the short stories that we could find that hadn't been published. And one of these was a piece called Detective Writers in England. But because it's non-fiction, we decided really it didn't belong in a book of Agatha Christie short stories. And so this typescript has sat in the file at HarperCollins for the last, 15 years. I then got in touch with the Detection Club, and we had the opportunity to publish a novel of theirs. And I thought, you know, this would be a great opportunity, because in it, Agatha talks about her contemporaries.
The provenance of this is really, really bizarre. Is it actually true that it was commissioned as propaganda and published in a Russian magazine?
Yes, so it seems. And this is something that is mentioned in the biography of Agatha Christie that Janet Morgan wrote shortly after Agatha died. And indeed, she was asked by the Ministry of Information to write a piece about crime fiction that was going to be published, and indeed was published, in a Russian magazine just after the end of the Second World War. The context, it seems to be slightly lost, but it would appear that the piece was designed to sort of explain, you know, some of the Western culture, and to explain a bit about crime writing. And Agatha, who was somebody who really didn't court publicity at all, seemed to rise to the challenge because she's a little bit indiscreet about some of her peers, presumably because she assumed that, destined as it was for overseas consumption, that none of them would actually see it themselves.
It's quite, there's a lovely bit of irony in this, that one of the people that she's rude about, if one can indeed call him a person, is Peter Wimsey, who is Dorothy Sayers' famous detective, who makes an appearance in the novel to which this essay has become a preface.
That's one of the bits of serendipity that made it fit rather well. The book is called Ask a Policeman, and it was written by half a dozen crime writers. It was published in 1933, and the Infant Detection Club, as it was then and which is still going now, was looking for ways to raise funds because, I mean, essentially it was a dining club for crime writers.
They just basically wanted to pay for their own dinners, didn't they?
Yeah, I think so. I think it pretty much came down to that, although they were also hiring premises where they could meet. And the idea was, like a lot of writing clubs, the authors would come together and share ideas and help each other out if they got a bit stuck. But essentially, it was a social thing. And so they needed some funds. And so the members would get together occasionally and write these books together. And the first one was called The Floating Admiral. That we republished last year. And Agatha Christie actually wrote one of the chapters in that book, Fiendishly Difficult Thing, where somebody writes a chapter and then hands it on to another writer and, you know, carry on with that. And remarkably, it seemed to work. And Ask a Policeman was a follow-up. And Agatha hadn't contributed to the novel itself. Sadly, a lot of these writers are either completely forgotten about these days or just don't have the profile that Agatha has. And being slightly shameless as a publisher, you know, if we can get Agatha Christie's name on the cover, then obviously that's of value.
So you're talking about people like Millwood Kennedy and John Rode and Gladys Mitchell, who I have to say I haven't heard of. Laura, you probably have, of course, being steeped in this stuff.
Yeah, I think Gladys Mitchell is, there aren't many published now. I think there's a copyright problem with it, but they're wonderful books. Philip Larkin was a massive fan. He called her the Great Gladys.
Now, we've been a bit slightly snooty about the Detection Club, which I gather you are a member of, Laura.
I am, yes.
So what do you get up to these days?
Well, it's very convivial, and there is a bit of sort of talking shop. But, you know, when authors get together, I think people think that it's this sort of tweedy Xanadu and it's all terribly high-minded. Most of the time, we just moan about money like everybody else does nowadays, really. But it is very nice. There are dinners a few times a year, very often in the Garrick Club, which is lovely, and they sort of let women in for the occasion, providing we don't stray up the stairs or anything like that. Then there's one at the Dorchester where new members are elected in a secret ceremony, the details of which I cannot discuss on pain of never selling a book again.
Oh, so it's a little bit like the Masons, is it?
Well, yeah, except that you can find the whole thing on Wikipedia if you're so minded. Which I doubt you can with the Masons.
Now, like Agatha, as she said in that little bit that we quoted at the beginning, you've written historical crime fiction, which is one of the many genres of within this genre, if indeed it is a genre. I get very confused. And in fact, A Willing Victim, your most recent, was shortlisted for the 2012 Crime Writers Association's Ellis Peters Award. Congratulations.
That's right. That's the historical dagger. In fact, historical crime fiction has become much, much more popular. And 20th century stuff, which is what I write, I don't feel any sort of connection with the minds of anybody before about 1900. It's too remote. But there is a lot now, which is the 40s, the 50s, the 60s.
And yours are particularly around the 40s.
Well, my detective ages in real time. And the books move forward from 1940 in 2 or 3 year increments every time. This is not only because I didn't want to write about the same period all the time, it's because that means he'll have to retire and I can get rid of him. That I love him dearly, but I don't want to be stuck with him. And many writers of serious characters, including Agatha Christie, who, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think came to hate Poirot.
Oh, yes, David, talk a little bit about this. That's absolutely, seems to be absolutely right. She's very rude about him in this essay, isn't she? Poor old Hercule. I'm very fond of him myself.
Well, lots of people are, and I don't think Agatha ever, you know, wanted to dismiss him completely out of hand. But by the time that she wrote this piece, she had been writing about Hercule for 20 years, and even in his first book, he's at the point of retirement. I mean, some have said rather uncharitably, but that by the time he died, actually, he must have clocked up at least 120 years.
But he, of course, doesn't age in real time. He remains the same.
No, that's right. Although Agatha was right, of course, she wrote for 5 decades, and the books that she wrote in the 60s do, you know, have very much a 1960s flavour to them. So time was rolling on, even if Hercule Poirot's age wasn't. And certainly Agatha came to prefer Miss Marple, but her publishers, William Collins, kept saying, well, we want another Poirot, because that's what people wanted.
So do you not think it's significant that she kills Poirot? She doesn't kill Miss Marple, but in Curtain, she kills him.
Yes, she did.
And, psychologically, I'm sure that is.
I hope that's not given too much away.
As the keeper of the Agatha Christie estate, let's just go back on this. You are the publisher of estates.
Well, I've got a slightly odd job in the publishing world, because most publishers of my ilk spend most of their time looking for great new novels and signing them up. People like Laura, indeed. But I have this particular role, which is to almost to keep alive many of the authors that we've had in the past. And so I look after, I mean, Agatha is by far one of the biggest that I have. And I also look after J.R.R. Tolkien and authors such as Alastair MacLean, Patrick O'Brien, authors who no longer generate new books, but whom we want to put the attention to detail in publishing, make sure they don't get forgotten about.
Laura, just bringing you back to that business of retirement age, Ian Rankin has famously brought his, probably the most famous detective of all, back. And when I asked him about this at Edinburgh, he said, well, they've got rid of the retirement age, so he wouldn't have to go into retirement now. So, in fact, you don't have to retire your...
Well, except that my detective chap, of course, is... It's now 1958, the book I'm writing at the moment, and he is 53, and at that time he would have had to retire.
So Ted Stratton is not going to do a Rebus?
No, I don't think so. I think that by the time I've done a few more books, that will be, I've had enough, I think, probably. Mm-hmm. I could be completely wrong about this.
At the point at which Ask a Policeman, I've been doing a little bit of research, you see, at the point at which Ask a Policeman was published in the UK, Dashiell Hammett had recently published The Maltese Falcon. He published that in 1930. And he was presumably working on The Thin Man, because that came out in 1934. And actually in 1933, Raymond Chandler's first professional work, Blackmailers Don't Shoot, was published in a magazine. So you had this stuff going on this side of the Atlantic. On the other side, you had the beginning of Hard Boiled, which is a totally different sort of tradition.
Yeah, I think because of the relative fame and reputation of some of the people involved, there is a perception that all American crime writing has its roots in Hard-Boiled, Noir School, Black Mask magazine and that kind of thing. So you're talking about Chandler and Hammett, James M. Cain and so on, and that everything in what's called the Golden Age in Britain, which between the wars, really, is cosy. That's not, in fact, the case. There is, sadly, underrated and I think underpublished, although a lot of them are coming back now, British authors like Gerald Kirsch, who wrote Night in the City, James Curtis, who wrote The Guilt Kid, and then, of course, you get wonderful Patrick Hamilton, who wrote Hangover Square, and that there's quite a lot of books like that. But the reputation of those writers has sort of paled in comparison to people like Chandra and Hammett and co, who are really regarded as the grandfathers of it.
Partly because the word hard-boiled has come to stand for sort of an industrialised America, hasn't it? It's a sort of genre of social commentary as well as of crime, isn't it?
Very much so. I think there is some social commentary in Agatha Christie, but it's very much the case, I think, and again, do correct me if I'm wrong, that there's a sort of nice little society, which is maybe a village, country house, something like that, on the whole. A murder is done and the social order is in upheaval and is overturned. The detective, say Hercule Poirot or Miss Marple, comes in and puts everything back. And the social order, the status quo isn't really questioned. And also noir is largely the really dark. It's about losers. It's about people you would cross motorways to avoid. Whereas you probably have quite a lot of fun with, you know, Colonel Mustard.
Let's leave Colonel Mustard firmly in the broom cupboard. We're going to go across the Atlantic to talk to a new practitioner, one of the up-and-coming stars of the American, what could be, I mean, you'd say she would be possibly an heir of hard-boiled Attica Locke. She read from her latest novel, The Cutting Season, and discussed it with Richard Lee.
The plantation proper sat on 18 acres, bordered to the north by the river and to the east by the raw, unincorporated landscape of Ascension Parish. To walk it from the library in the northwest corner to the gift shop and on to the main house, past the stone kitchen and the rose garden, the cottages Manette and Leroy, the old schoolhouse and the quarters, took nearly an hour. Karen had learned to start her days early, while it was quiet, heading out before sunlight, having arranged for Letty to arrive by 6 a.m. at least 3 days a week while Karen's daughter was still sleeping. 5 mornings out of 7, she made a full sweep of the property, combing every square inch, noting any scuffed floors or dry flower beds or drapes that needed to be steamed, even one time changing the motor in one of the gallery's ceiling fans herself. She didn't mind the work. Bellevue was her job, and she was nothing if not professional. Though she could in no way have prepared herself for the grisly sight before her now. To the south and west, across a nearly 5-foot-high fence where Karen was standing, the back 500 acres of the Clancy family's 157-year-old property had been leased for cane farming since before she was born. Over the fence line, puffs of gray smoke shot up out of the fields. The machines were out in the cane this morning, already on the clock. The mechanical cutters were big and wide as tractor trucks, fat, gassy beasts whose engines often disturbed the natural habitat, chasing rats and snakes and rabbits from their nests in the cane fields. And come each and every harvest, the animals invariably sought out a safe and peaceful living on the grounds of Bellevue. Luis had run them out of the garden, cleared their fecal waste from his tool shed, and on more than one occasion, trapped and bagged a specimen to take home for God knows what purpose. And now, some critter had dug up the dirt and grass along the plantation's fence line and come up with this. The body was face down, in a makeshift grave so shallow that its walls hugged the corpse as snugly as a shell, as if the dead woman at Karen's feet were on the verge of hatching, of emerging from her confinement to start this life over again. She was coated with mud, top to bottom, her arms and legs tucked beneath her body, the spine in a faint, curved position. The word fetal came to Karen's mind. She thought for a brief, dizzying second that she might faint. "Don't touch her," she said. "Don't touch a thing."
Where did the idea for The Cutting Season come from? What took you to an old plantation in Louisiana?
I went to a wedding in 2004 at the Oak Alley Plantation in Vacherie, Louisiana. And it was kind of a life-changing event. I'd never been on a plantation before, even though I am born and raised in the American South. But I probably, if it had not been invited to this wedding, I never would have gone to a plantation. It's not the kind of thing that I would have sought out.
You were for a day trip or whatever?
No. I would have gotten whatever history I needed from books, and that would have been enough for me. So that when I got to this land, I wasn't prepared for what it would feel like to not be in a picture, but to actually be standing on land where, if not my literal ancestors, then my spiritual ancestors had labored. And I was just blown away by the entire experience and also confused by the fact that I was at a wedding, that this space, you know, that was meant to represent and preserve history had also been turned into like an events venue.
A terrible history at that.
I mean, exactly.
Not something to be celebrated.
Exactly. And yet we were having champagne and it was a wedding. This place also has a bed and breakfast, a restaurant, a gift shop. And in their gift shop, you know, to their credit, they sell, you know, kitschy, like mammy figures. But then they also sell historical texts out of universities about the time period and about the area. I think the place is trying to find a balance, which also to me kind of is a metaphor for my country trying to find this balance between, you know, where we've been versus where we're going.
And that kind of balance, that space to be negotiated seemed ripe to you for a novel.
Yes. I mean, when I at the wedding, I remember thinking I could write a dissertation about this. But of course, you know, I have no PhD, so I wrote a novel. Exactly.
And so where did the idea of the story come from? Where did Karen come from?
when I made the decision to write this book and I started doing a lot of research about sugar plantations and the sugar industry and slavery and Reconstruction, I found a book that was a series of letters home from a plantation mistress to her mother. And the letters spanned the years right before the Civil War, through the Civil War, and after. And when I read that book in 2009, I was stunned to discover that I actually had more in common with the plantation mistress than I did with the slaves. And I wasn't prepared for that at all. But the truth of the matter is, I felt like a woman who works at home, was trying to run a business. I needed outside help. The people who were coming to watch my children and to help clean my house so that I could do my job were of a different culture, spoke a different language. I didn't know how they felt about me, how much they trusted me. And it made me feel very uncomfortable.
So Karen is the kind of the embodiment of that confrontation right there.
Exactly, exactly.
All of the strands of the novel pass right through her.
Yes.
Her ancestors having worked as slaves on the same plantation where she is, her mother being a cook for the big house,
yes.
Her childhood running around with Bobby, one of the white men in the big house again. Was it clear to you that this character would be your detective, as it were?
Yes. The image of the caretaker for the plantation, the general manager, having a simple morning of inspecting the property and coming upon a woman's body. That was always very clear in my mind. And so she was going to be the filter through everything. And I think what she also allows is she's the perfect vessel to look at our discomfort around our history. You know, because on the surface, and Karen has this great moment where she's sitting in her office in the big house, and where she has a view of the fields where her ancestors cut cane. And so there's this sense of, well, if I've arrived here, shouldn't this feel better than it actually does? I think that for people of color and also for women, that our economic and political progress is fraught, is complicated. We're always kind of mindful of other people who aren't coming with us. If you're a woman, I think it's because in order for you to ascend professionally, you need a series of usually other women who are holding up your household in order for you to leave the house to go do.
Looking after your kids.
So looking after your kids, cooking for you, cleaning. And so you're constantly aware of that woman's life. You're carrying that with you into the boardroom. And I think for people of color, there's a sense of understanding that everybody of your race is not always coming with you. And is that okay? Am I allowed to like celebrate the fact that I'm in the big house if I know that other people can't come with me?
Yeah, the characters in your book history seems ever present for them. The black characters who act in the play, who hang around in tattered calico to earn a bit of extra money, as if that's kind of fine.
Yeah.
I mean, is that how it feels, that it's both kind of always there and yet pushed to one side of your mind?
Where I'm from in the South, I think it is like that. I mean, I went back to Oak Alley to stay in one of the not a slave cabin, they're guest cottages, because I knew I couldn't write the book unless I did that. But when I went there and I went around with the gentleman who runs the American Sugarcane League, and he asked me, where are you staying? And I said, oh, Oak Alley Plantation. He said, oh, yes, that's where we had our anniversary dinner. And, you know, I think people in the South both are revering the history because they're preserving it. But at the same time, it's this just thing that you drive past taking your kids to school.
The house itself is almost like another character, isn't it? It's kind of alive with that history. Karen's former partner goes to visit the shacks, as you did. And the shacks almost seem to be looking back at him, this black man in a wool gabardine and shoes, a $500 watch on his wrist. That could be a moment of kind of victory. But they never seem to be even close to that. Do you think that's...
I think those are my feelings. And I don't know that it's a pull, like we'll never get past it. I think that we just... And not in a sense of like weighing down pull, but it's like a rubber band connection that I know that when I went to Oak Alley for both the wedding and when I stayed, years later in one of the cottages, I felt a sense of gratitude. I said a prayer of thank you. If there were spirits there, I wanted to say thank you and kind of acknowledge what you did then matters, because I'm sitting here now free and I will never forget that. My hope for my country is that we're able to never forget while basking more so in freedom. It's because, you know, people have called slavery the original sin. I think the point of it isn't even just so much time and distance, but that the country was founded on a contradiction. It was founded on freedom while people were not free. And so that's the part that why we can't get over it. And then I also think that we haven't done a good job. You know, South Africa had the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. There was, you know, a concerted effort to call things out, say, I'm sorry, say this was awful. You know, we haven't really done that.
Is it too late for that now?
No, it's not too late, but we can't even get to talking like that because there's so many other problems going on. There's been this cultural thing where if you acknowledge race, you're somehow not only rude, but like immoral in a way, that to in any way acknowledge the tension, the history, that you were even connected to people that did something awful is makes people very uncomfortable. And there is a part of me, frankly, that has compassion for it. That in one of the last scenes of the book, when Karen, who is this descendant of a slave, is standing in the big house with Raymond Clancy, who's the descendant of a slave owner. And he says, why the hell should I be, you know, held to task for something somebody did, some white man did 200 years? I didn't have anything to do with it. And I actually have compassion for that argument. Neither of us, the oppressed or the oppressor, asked for our history.
I'm wondering why you chose crime fiction as a vehicle for exploring these complicated issues.
First of all, I'm just drawn to it as a reader, even the kinds of television I watch or movies. But I also think that what the genre elements do for me is help to keep me grounded in a story so that I don't get kind of lost in my big philosophical ideas. And I also think that I understand issues better through human behavior. I think it makes me a little bit more compassionate. Because if I'm talking about politics, it's easy for me to get angry and filled with blame. But if I'm talking about flesh and blood human beings, it's much harder, for me at least, to just completely blame people. I'm more inclined to find compassion, to find similarities between human beings.
Through fiction rather than through nonfiction. I had to actually cover up my proof copy at home with its tagline, which describes the body of a young woman lying face down in a shallow grave, her throat cut. Do you have kids yourself? I'm wondering if you feel a kind of similar ambivalence about the kind of violence at the heart of the book.
And of course, my daughter's gender is caught up in my obsession with crime fiction. And what I mean by that is, specifically in America, there is a feeling of always walking through life as a woman with the knowledge of violence around a corner. That you are smaller and potentially less strong physically than half of the population.
Yeah, there's that scene where Karen's walking on her own in the dark through the plantation.
Yes, and I think I think some women readers get out of crime fiction a cautionary tale, a way to test your skill set. Would I, in a situation, be able to tell? Would I hear that noise? Would my instinct tell me something's off? Could I tell a liar? And so I think part of my fascination with all of this is, I don't know, a fantasy that if I test it out on paper, that maybe in real life
it's going to be okay.
Be okay.
Attica Locke there talking to Richard Lee about The Cutting Season. David and Laura are still with me here in the studio. Laura, you're quite political, aren't you? Your own fiction can be political.
Fairly, yeah. The purpose of my Stratton series, without wanting to sound pompous, is not only to write crime fiction, which I love, but it's also in a way to discover how we got to where we are today. The changing nature, it's a social history of Britain, beginning in the Second World War and carrying on through the late 40s, the 50s and the 60s, which I contend is the time when Britain changed the most in the shortest period of years. It's seen through the eyes of a London policeman, so Ted Stratton is my sort of viewing platform for that, because obviously what sort of crimes occur is absolutely emblematic of the time you're living in.
David, I'd like to pick up with you this business of political writing among the people in your estate.
Well, I'm not sure that political writing occurs very much, certainly in the classic whodunits. I mean, these are stories designed for entertainment. They're a puzzle. By necessity, they're pumped out. They're for entertainment. Yes, they are essentially going to be rather not sanitized, but slightly artificial. I think the misconception when we talk about cozy crime, for example, as coming from that golden age, is that therefore somehow that it's all rather easy. I don't think it is. I think a lot of what is suggested in these books is happens below the surface, in that they might not be graphic, but they're usually quite brutal. The social and family situations that quite often underpin them are quite fraught. You know, people are falling in and out of love and having affairs, and you know, it's all suggested. So it's not cozy in that it's they might be having afternoon tea, but still the jealousies and the nastiness is there below the surface. So things like politics tend not to come into them because that outside world starts to intrude.
There is a reason why the novels of the Golden Age, which began just after the Great War, are what you call emotionally neutral. The Great War was the most traumatic, terrible thing, not only for the men who fought in it, but for the families who left behind. And you then, in the 20s, got not only the bright young things, all these people being terrifically frivolous, which was obviously one sector of society only, but it was also novels of people like Agatha Christie. I don't think it's a coincidence at the same time you got the rise of things like the crossword and puzzles like that. And I think it's that sort of...
Something to distract the mind.
Yeah, mental absorption without having emotional commitment, because you've just had so much of that in the most terrible way.
Now I'm just going to turn us to talking, maybe exploring more about the writers who we should remember. Some quite interesting names have come out of the open thread I put up on the website earlier this week. Puzzle Doctor recommended She Died a Lady by Carter Dixon. Carter Dixon is one of the writers that Agatha Christie rates more highly than anyone else in this essay at the beginning of this very book.
Yes, that's right. At that time, he was a very prominent writer. Sadly, doesn't have the prominence now. There were a number of these, and I mean, fortunately, and quite often thanks to the rise of TV or film adaptations, the likes of Marjorie Allingham, Niall Marsh, Dorothy Sayers, they were known as the crime queens. They are much better remembered than many of these others. But these books are there to be searched out, either through bookshops or, of course, thanks to the digital age and the ability to download books, a lot more of these are becoming more available. So they are there to be discovered all over again.
And there are people out there snooping them out. I think this is what's rather wonderful, and talking to each other about them. Another of our readers, called Novelista, bigs up Ted Lewis. Do you know anything about Ted Lewis?
Ted Lewis wrote a book called Jack's Return Home, which was filmed as Get Carter. And I managed to get hold of a copy a few years ago. Great difficulty, I think. Now it is back in print. Absolutely fantastic book. Highly recommended.
And he says if you've read that, then try Billy Ragg's Plender and GBH, which he thinks is his masterpiece.
No, which I haven't read and now will do. And if people do want a pointer at the great novels of yesteryear, an anthology of essays where crime writers pick out their favourite from the past, and it's called Books to Die For, and it's edited by John Connolly, the novelist, and Declan Burke, and that's got the most fantastic range of stuff.
But that's enough of the historical stuff for the time being. What of the future? And in particular, what are the kids of today reading? A lot of fantasy, though, as someone pointed out, Harry Potter is really a whodunit when you peel all the layers away. One new writer who's arrived with a bang is Tanya Byrne, whose very first novel, The Heart-Shaped Bruise, became the only novel for teenagers and young adults ever to have been shortlisted for a Crime Writers Association award, in this case, the John Creasy New Blood Dagger for debut novelists.
Juliet, I know you've been waiting 3 months for this letter, but I have to start by saying that this isn't an apology. I'm not sorry. I'm not. If I have to spend the rest of my life crossing that word out of every dictionary I find, I will. So if that's what you've been waiting for me to say, while you keep writing me, stop reading now. This is the only letter I'm going to write you, and the only reason I'm writing it is because you keep asking me why I did what I did. I guess you don't believe them when they say that I'm out of my mind. I don't know, I might be. My normal and everyone else's normal isn't the same anymore. Mine is out of time, like I'm a record playing at the wrong speed or something. That's why I'm letting them do this to me, why I swallow their pills and sit here scratching my sins into the walls. But that's not why I did it. You must know that, otherwise you wouldn't be asking. So okay, you want to know why? This is why. You stabbed my father. That's it. What don't you understand? China shop rules, Juliet. You break it, you pay for it. And you broke me. You got what you deserved. Now leave me alone. Emily.
Tanya, welcome. That was Emily in sort of typically forthright address mode, actually not telling the entire truth, is she? No. She's a really, really complicated character.
She is.
Her father got stabbed by this girl that she's pursuing. But it wasn't as if he was killed or anything. We don't quite know why she's so wound up about it, do we?
The issue is that she doesn't react like a normal 17-year-old girl, because she's not a normal 17-year-old girl. The book starts in the psychiatric unit of a young offenders institution, and so it's quite obvious that she's not all there, to put it politely. So I think what happens is that Emily's life falls apart, and from that moment where her father's stabbed, and she blames Juliet for it, and that's not necessarily the right thing to do, but that's how she's got it in her head, that if Juliet hadn't stabbed her father, none of this would have happened.
Now, we have to get it clear right at the start that actually Emily's name for most of the book is Rose.
Yes.
And Juliet's name for most of the book is Nancy.
Yes, that's right.
Tell us about this.
There's two girls, Juliet and Emily. And Juliet's father is a police officer who's investigating a family of gangsters called the Coles. And Harry Cole goes in, breaks into the house and stabs the police officer, and Juliet comes home, doesn't know what's going on, and in an effort to protect her father, stabs Harry. And that's how the story begins. And then from that moment, she goes into witness protection and becomes a new girl called Nancy, and she starts her life again and moves to London. And Emily, upon hearing this, finds out where she is in witness protection and decides to befriend her in an attempt to ruin her life. So she becomes Rose, and Juliet becomes Nancy, and their lives start again.
You've made quite a complicated formal decision for yourself, haven't you? This is a first novel. You really set yourself high barriers here.
Yeah.
So she's telling it in a journal. She's telling a story in which she's partially herself.
Yeah.
There are a series of almost subterfuges going on. Yeah. She's not honest with herself. She's not honest with other people. Mm-hmm. We're hearing it from one girl who's telling a story about herself as a fictional character. Mm-hmm. How on earth did you manage this plot?
It was quite complicated, and I actually wrote the whole book from Juliet's point of view, about a girl that goes into witness protection when her father's stabbed and has to start a life again and goes to college and meets a boy and falls in love. And I finished it and I was really pleased with it. And then I asked a friend to read it, as always is the case. She thought it needs more tension. So I added a character called Emily that showed up about a third of the way through the book and just wreaked havoc. And I got about halfway through and I thought, actually, I think Emily's story is more interesting. I think Juliet's story's been told before in films and books, but there's something about Emily's story, about her brokenness almost, that appealed to me as a writer. Because you can push villains so much further than you can the good guy. You can always get them to say stuff that you wouldn't normally say and kind of cross that line and see where you end up, where you would never do that in real life. So I said this to my friend who read it, and she said, no, it'd never work. No one would want to read a story from a villain's point of view. No one would have any sympathy for her. And I was like, well, then that's my job as a writer, to write something that they will feel sympathy for. It was like a challenge almost. I thought, I can do this. So I literally, as soon as she sent that email, opened up Word and started again and told the whole story from Emily's point of view. And I think the thing is that Rose is actually more Emily than Emily is, because when Emily finds out her father's a gangster, and she had no idea, she was just this quiet, bookish girl who played the cello that went to boarding school and was daddy's little princess. She overnight becomes this gangster's daughter, so she adopts this persona, this kind of swagger, and she swears. The only time she swears is ever with her psychiatrist. It's like she smokes and she swears and stuff. But when she's Rose, that's who she really is, when she's kind of a little bit more quiet and funny and vulnerable almost. So actually she has to become someone else to be who she really wants to be. So it basically is the same story as what's happened to Juliet going into witness protection, in that she has to change her name and lie about who she is and make up all these memories. It's just told from her point of view.
You've set yourself also a research challenge. You're dealing with mental illness, you're dealing with young offenders institutions.
I did a lot of research, and the the issue with writing a journal is that you can't info dump a lot of stuff in there. And I think, especially from Emily's point of view, because she's so in denial about things, that she wouldn't really talk about her mental illness. So I had to show, don't tell a lot of stuff. So I did a lot of research into what happens in young offenders institutions. And I actually discovered in the first draft, Emily was seeing Dr. Gilyard every day, and I discovered that they wouldn't have the resources for that to happen. So that got changed to once a week. So I did a lot of research into that, and kind of the art therapy and the music therapy are all kind of therapies that Emily would have for her illness. She's got BPD, but it wouldn't, which is behavioural personality disorder, but it wouldn't be diagnosed yet because she's under 18. Well, she just turned 18 when she goes in. And actually the purpose of a place like that isn't to fix her, which is an issue that comes up later in the book. It's actually to make sure she's all right to go to trial.
Now, you're almost making it sound worthy, and I can assure anyone listening to this that it is not worthy at all. It's absolutely tantalising, and you never actually know until right at the end what it is she's actually done that's landed her there.
Yeah. She talks a lot about being evil. I'm evil and I've done this awful thing, but she won't admit to... She's a very manipulative narrator in that sense, because she only tells you what she wants you to know. So that's why she doesn't discuss her illness, because she's in denial about it. So a lot of it is her slowly coming to terms and telling the story. That's why she says very early on, I think in the first chapter, that she leaves pieces of herself around London, like she'll write on the back of receipts and leave like a compliment for a waitress or write on a bathroom door. And that's what she does. She tells the story in pieces. She tells some bits to her doctor and some bits to her friends and some bits to the diary. And it's up to you to kind of put it all together, really, and to work out why she is the way that she is. And actually, she doesn't care. She doesn't understand why she is the way she is. So she's not going to sit there for ages talking about, you know, depression or not being able to sleep, but those things are in there. She's lost weight and she's not sleeping and all those things are there, but she doesn't really understand why.
That was Tanya Byrne talking about The Heart-Shaped Bruise, which is just out in paperback from Headline. Winner of the John Creasy Award will be revealed at the Specsavers Crime Thriller Awards on October the 18th. And that's just about all from us this week, but we do have one little treat left for you. It's a preview of Tom Hollander reading from the opening of J.K. Rowling's first novel for adults, The Casual Vacancy.
Barry Fairbrother did not want to go out to dinner. He had endured a thumping headache for most of the weekend and was struggling to make a deadline for the local newspaper. However, his wife had been a little stiff and uncommunicative over lunch, and Barry deduced that his anniversary card had not mitigated the crime of shutting himself away in the study all morning. It did not help that he'd been writing about Crystal, whom Mary disliked, although she pretended otherwise. "Mary, I want to take you out to dinner," he had lied, to break the frost. 19 years, kids, 19 years, and your mother's never looked lovelier." Mary had softened and smiled, so Barry had telephoned the golf club because it was nearby and they were sure of getting a table. He tried to give his wife pleasure in little ways, because he had come to realise, after nearly 2 decades together, how often he disappointed her in the big things. It was never intentional.
There's that C word right up at the start of the novel, though we are assured that early intelligence that The Casual Vacancy was strictly crime fiction was a red herring, set loose by none other than Ian Rankin. You can find out for yourself about The Casual Vacancy by downloading it from audible.co.uk, and you can read all about it in The Guardian's Saturday review and The Observer's new review on Sunday. Do let us know what you think about those or anything on this podcast at guardian.co.uk/books. From me, Claire Armistead, and my producer, Tim Mabey, goodbye.
Hi, I'm Simon Hattonstone. I'm a Guardian journalist, and I occasionally write books that are not read by many people. Let me tell you about some of the great advice from those who really know how to do it. Top name authors that you can read in a new Guardian book called Write. It's brilliant. Funny, perverse, bonkers and wise. If it sounds like writing, then I rewrite, says Elmore Leonard. There's Anne Enright for despairing writers. Remember, the first 12 years are the worst. So, don't put off that dream of winning the Booker Prize any longer. Get inspired by our new Guardian book, Write. You can get yours for half price, £6.50, using promo code PODCAST. To order, visit guardian.co.uk/bookshop. Anytime up to the end of October.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.